It's the First Time podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Kate Mildenhall, international jet setter, you're back.
I'm back. Can't you see the kind of just Bali chill just oozing off me?
Oh, you're dripping in chill. I was going to ask about Bali braids because on the Darabin Mothers group, which is the Facebook page where I live, Bali braids are a controversial thing, but you mentioned off air. You did, not you personally.
Yes. People did partake, but let me also be very clear in without mentioning any names. In saying that some of our group from the inner north did not partake in the braiding. I'm not going to go into that, neither here nor there for me. The interesting thing, we had people come because, of course, there were, let's just recap.
100 of you. There were millions in the photo. You had a photo at the end and it's literally multiple couches, people sitting,
standing. Don't even know how they make a couch that long. But yes, there were 29 of us, 15 children, ranging in age from 3 to 13. And many of
and
the children
friends,
got braids.
Not family. In my head, it was family, which is cool too.
That family does exist within this group of friends. But the key thing being that most of us went to school to it. The average age of knowing each other is somewhere around 20 years. Some of us, at least one of the women and I, go back more than 30 years. So, you know, it's your oldies. You can't get away with much, I must say. And you know what was really great about that?
Trying to get away with in Bali.
No. You can't get away with much personally. Like it's thing. Right. You know what I actually have? We have talked about this before. Brendan, what's his name that I've interviewed?
Plum.
He wrote Cowell. Plum. Yes, yep. Brendan Cowell. In his first book, How It Feels, which I absolutely loved, there is a quote which I still have up on my desk just above me. And it begins with, the epigraph is from Patrick White, and it is, either you turn your back forever on those who have seen your youth, or else you will admit its nakedness, and even shame has some sweet melancholy. And that's the kind of thing of it, right? These people have known me since I was 13, 14, 15. And that's what I mean with you can't get away with much. Mm. And one of the joyful things about going, because I've got home and realized we're recording this a week ahead of it going to air, but I've got home and realized like it's 3 weeks today until my book comes out. It's getting very close. It'll be 2 weeks when this comes out. And, you know, there's a kind of a panicky feeling that comes along with that. And with that lot, as much as they are super duper excited for me and for the book and very proud of me, also I'm just one of the gang. It doesn't really matter what any of us do. It matters, can you get the kids in and out of the pool and can you do a great classic catch and can you order enough food for 29 people? Or, you know, that's what matters. And so that was a really good kind of chill out space just to hang. And that was delightful. Also, it made me think, because some of the people in that gang work in, you know, they do save lives and they do build bridges and they do, you know, roll out vaccines, et cetera. And they do work in remote communities and kind of keep communities together. And what it was making me think about was that piece of advice that Ling Ma gave in the interview that I did with Ling Ma, which I loved doing so much.
I started that interview. I haven't gotten to the advice yet.
Oh, you haven't got. So the advice is terrific. The advice is advice that one of her friends gave her, which is there are no creative writing emergencies. Like there just isn't. In the end, you're writing a book. And I know that sometimes we have to be in that zone of going, and so often we're like, what we do is important and my art is my work and this is important. On the flip side of that, what I'm doing is putting sentences on a page and as such, no one's going to die if I don't do that. Yeah. And so let's just take the pressure off a bit. And so there was also that element of going like, yeah, I got a book coming out. It's 4 years work. Yeah, it is a big deal to me, but also there's a lot going on in the world, you know?
There is something about that that is comforting in terms of its meaninglessness.
Yes.
Isn't there? Like it's a real perspective on, it doesn't really matter.
What does anything matter?
Which is comforting more than it's dismissive in my head anyway.
I must tell you, because I know that you will be proud of me, the most scary thing that I did was I went down the very biggest ride on Waterbomb Park in Kuta. Never did I imagine myself saying that I would go to Kuta, but I did. And I went down the one that, like, you go to the very top and then you get locked inside a little capsule and then they count you down and then the thing just slides out from under your foot and you free fall until you hit the slide and then you go, oh, my goodness, it was so scary.
I feel sick even just listening to that description. We have gone to Watermark and I have been convinced to go on the slides because we've been there for kids' birthdays and I've done it completely under duress and have felt seasick at the end of it. Just everything about it I find revolting. The anticipation, the dropping, the darkness. Oh, I don't know how you did it. Impressive.
All the things. There were lots of amusing things. Also, one of my children in a big gang of our kids, they got stuck on one of the slides and had to be rescued. When something deflated. So that was pretty funny once they got through the, like, terrible anxiety.
Oh, my God, and, that's awful.
Well, they were fine. They didn't have much further to go and it was fine. Tell me, can you update us on where you are with bookish things, Catherine Collette?
Today I signed the contract.
Yeah.
So a few episodes ago now, we had a conversation about me having an offer and a deal for a middle grade books. You and I discussed it at length. I had not actually signed the contract. So while we had it in the post that goes out if people have subscribed via WordPress, we deleted it. I had to kind of carefully cut it out of the audio episode because, as Jacinta, my agent, pointed out, the ink was not dry yet. So flash forward.
Not dry.
How many months did that take? A couple of months. Can officially announce I have a two-book deal for middle grade books that will be set in the same place, so not a sequel, but in the same world with HarperCollins Kids.
Woohoo! This is so exciting.
Yeah,
when do we get to see these books and what are you up to?
So the first one will come out September-ish next year. I haven't started doing edits yet. I'm also doing the illustrations, which is super fun. And the second book will come out, I think, about 6 months after the first.
This is so exciting. I am so, so excited about these books. You mentioned off air that it's a kind of a two-part thing, right? And we've talked about this because you're both doing the writing and you're doing the illustrations. What is the most difficult right now?
I haven't touched it, so I don't really know. I'm waiting for the edits, but I think the illustrations will be harder. Feels like you could easily do a big investment of time and then completely throw it out in a way that I suspect you do with writing all the time, but just feels like a different entity. On the topic of books being published, you said 3 weeks until The Hummingbird Effect comes out. We are obviously planning to do multiple deep dives, or a long deep dive that will be broken into multiple episodes. But we had a back and forth about whether we were doing that today. And in the message, you said, can you just remind me? Because if we are, I need to remember what my book is about.
Right. So one of the things that happened... I do know what my book is about, but as we have mentioned before, I'm already super excited and kind of working on a new book. And so my brain has been slightly elsewhere. Also, when I was in Bali, kind of a last minute thing came through for me to answer some questions about the book that needed to be done pronto. And it was partly holiday brain, right? Like, it was 4 or 5 days in. I was kind of deep in afternoon cocktails and, you know, finding the right crab at the night market zone by this stage. But I looked at these questions. Really beautiful, insightful questions, generous questions about the book that I had written. And I was like, who wrote this book that these questions are about? I don't know. I don't know the answers to these very insightful, wise questions. Luckily, I was with a large group of people and they could help me with the answers that I needed. to make
myself. For a second, I thought you were going to say, lucky for me, I had AI. I know that's a feature of the book.
It is a feature of the book, but I did not use it to help me answer the questions about the book. But there is that sense, I reckon, we've talked about this a lot in the past, that you the weird thing about doing publicity for your own book is you've often moved past it, or you're in such deep relief at no longer being in the book, even if you've worked on it for 4 years, you copy edits are done, you're like at least a couple of months past all that, that you really do have to go, okay, yeah, write that, character list, that they are the characters in my book and this is what I intended to do.
Sometimes you change your character name really late too.
Yes.
And yes, I have struggled to remember character
as
names.
As per my five bills, you know, there's no longer five bills in there, but who knows what I ended up calling them. Anyway, so that will be great to be reminded what indeed I am talking about. I have to mention that just before I flew off to Bali, in fact, the day before, I got my author dream came true and I got to go to Booktopia and sign my books and do the time lapse. I mean, sometimes it's a very simple thing that we want out of this writerly life. And basically that's what I wanted. And it was lots of fun.
Everything you hoped? Did you get RSI?
I didn't. It's actually, you get a weird spot on, it's actually kind of on your lower arm, inner arm, that's more like a paper thing.
Actually, I was looking up humble brags for something. This is the perfect humble brag.
Yeah, I've had this one in my pocket.
Yeah.
This slight rash I've got from the paper from
the
signing.
Ink off?
So many copies of my book. I think the funniest thing was that you would have the same thing. That obviously, being the chatty extrovert that I am, and also wanting to know all the gossip and all the stories about the whole history of Booktopia, that I was really actively trying to engage in conversation with Ben and everyone as I'm doing the signing. But of course, that thing, right, where you, if you're speaking a word and you're writing a word, that you end up. So I had to stop doing that because I very nearly did stuff up my own name.
Did you stuff any up? I always feel
I didn't that time. I salvaged. Used a great, I mean, I would love to know people's pen of preference. I did borrow the Booktopia pens they had on offer. You could either use a Sharpie, which is what I used last time for the mother fault, or you could they had a Uniball in a lovely blue. And I think that's going to be my pen of choice.
Mm-hmm. They almost need to offer those on a tray, don't they? Like to
with a chocolate next to it.
Yeah.
It is extraordinary seeing I think the joy, and I mean, let's be honest, I've written a book that's got a warehouse in it too. And I didn't go into the warehouse because they're actually moving. Booktopia is in the middle of moving.
Aren't they moving to a place with robots?
They are.
Yes.
And the robots have names. Yeah. So like, again, all of this stuff, I've written about this in the book, but the idea of seeing behind the scenes on everything about how our industry works, the way the people who are in charge of packing the books and where the books go and the time lags between things because you need this. And I'm just, it just blows my mind every time.
Yeah.
So that's the particular exciting thing about going to there. So that was fun. There's a bunch of events out. Melbourne is still, unfortunately, a sellout
and has been increased. This is like hundreds of people that
it's
are coming
increased,
to this event.
It's been increased, but it is still sold out. But there is a wait list. And what I'm encouraging people to do is to jump on the wait list if this is for the readings trades hall launch with Jacinta Parsons on August the 4th. There is a wait list feature there if you go on the link, and we will see what we can do, and we will make sure that people try and relinquish their tickets too if they can't come. But there's other Melbourne events as well, heaps of places. You know me, I'm a girl about town. I like to
get
out everywhere. So there'll be places, but there's also Brisbane, Sydney. In Brisbane, the gorgeous Mirandi Riwo is doing me the honour of launching at Avid on the 9th of August. Anna Downs is going to do the honours in Sydney on the 7th for Roaring Stories. Super fun. Working on my outfits, you know.
I was about to ask about outfits. Yeah.
I am working on the outfits. I tell you what, really enjoyed rocking out a suit for my first for Booktopia. Very
suits
psychological power.
Lots of nice suits at the moment, though, I
suits
think,
are
too.
About, and that, Yeah.
Same color dressing thing.
Mm. Yep. So that was a psychological lift, obviously. I'm going for sequins as well because, you know, I love them. Anyway, I'm working on it.
Oh,
he's looking after me. So they are all the things. Tell me, what have you been putting in your eyes and ears? And
my reading recommendation is Maya Linnell's Kookaburra Cottage. Yeah, such a lovely book. I got to see Kylie Orr interview Maya Linnell at Croydon Library in the holidays. She's a great host. Kylie Orr, very funny. Middle of the day, so 2:30 event. At Croydon Library, which is kind of eastern suburbs of Melbourne, packed.
Oh, with my
people.
Goodness.
Like heaps. Amazing. And heaps and heaps of people. So Maya is doing like a full book tour in multiple places. Maybe it's ended now. Maybe it's still ongoing. This is her fifth book. It's Rural Romance, which is very hard two words to say together.
A bit of Ruro. Is that what they call it? Is that the hashtag?
Is that what they
Ruro?
Call it?
I think so. I think it's Ruro.
Just lovely. I walked away thinking I should read more romance. Nothing bad happens. You're invested in the characters. This, as I said, it's her fifth book. After five books, you know exactly what you're doing. You feel in good hands. I absolutely burnt through it. Perfect holiday read. Highly recommend.
I love that. Can I back it up with another perfect holiday read romance? I am not sure if this is technically in the Ruro genre specifically, but let's give it a crack. It's Claire Fletcher's Five Bush Weddings. It is set in regional town, so I'm assuming that's allowed to be Ruro. I've had this on my TBR for a while. Claire actually has a brand new book coming out in August, I think, called Love Match, which is another rom-com. But
is it set around tennis, the new one?
No, it's set around, what's the football they do in Queensland?
Oh, rugby.
I think it's rugby, yeah. So... she says, not even knowing the word. Five Bush Weddings set around a character who is a wedding photographer. Again, I mean, some bad things do happen, but Claire just knows how to write. She really just knows how to write. The characters are great. It's kind of smart ass. It's funny. It gave me all the feels. Characters say great lines. I tore through it. I couldn't put it down. You know, I read it late into the night and just it's that feeling like you're obviously saying with Maya, where you just know you are in very competent hands. Mm. This person is going to deliver exactly the story that you want. Loved it. Five Bush Weddings, Claire Fletcher, and look out for her new one, Love Match.
Yeah, on that romance, I also went to the Willie Lit Fest, which is not back on until next year. They had a romance panel. Romance is fascinating, like just hearing people talk about it. If ever I have the opportunity, I always ask their approach to sex scenes as well.
Yes. And did you get any great tips?
Well, on this panel, there were three authors, and one said she used to write very explicit sex scenes, but I wasn't hosting the panel. This was just an audience question. But now she doesn't go so far in and shuts the door. And in fact, I think they all said they shut the door.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
Have you got more books?
I do. Two that I really want to mention. One is, again, new book. I think it hits shelves in August. It's called Something Bad Is Going to Happen. Mm. It is by Jessie Stevens, who you may know from her work at Mamma Mia, or her first book, Heartsick, nonfiction, which sold a bunch of copies. This is her first attempt at fiction, and it is really great. And I tell you what particularly got me. I wrote about this on Instagram. It's a book about a character, Adela, who's for a part of the book, and it moves back and forth in time, is in an inpatient psychiatric unit. And I could tell from the reading experience that Jessie knew exactly what she was talking about. The way she writes depression, the way she writes about the kind of care you might receive in inpatient unit, the way she writes about the family experiences and friends' experiences of dealing with mental illness. And so as soon as I finished, I kind of went in to see like, well, what's the research she's done here? What's the backstory behind the book? And it is in fact a very personal kind of reflection for Jessie. So it's based on some of her own experiences. And you can really, really tell that in the reading. She's really nailed that aspect of it. So look out for that one. Something Bad Is Going to Happen.
It's quite funny in real life too. Is the book funny, or is it?
Yes, it has. Absolutely, it has a comic line through it. So there's that serious aspect of it. But yeah, the dialogue, whip smart, very funny. Again, she knows how to write. She's a communicator. Like, this is her living. She knows what she's doing on the page. You feel like you're in really safe hands. You're going to talk to her, Catherine.
I know. I'm excited. So I'm like taking notes on the things that you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Really. I was very impressed. And the other one, I posted about this and I said, I must be the last person in the world to read this. And then a lot of other people said, no, you are not the last. I'm currently reading it, or I haven't read it yet. But the book is Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin. Have you read it?
It's on Nina Kenwood's list.
Oh my goodness.
It's great. It's really good.
I reckon I hadn't necessarily avoided it because of the hype. I just hadn't got to it. Like we always say, a lot of the reading we do is reading that arrives by the post for us. And this didn't arrive by the post. I am now so spewing that I had not read this before Gabrielle was in Melbourne and Sydney and doing events, because I just would have like chased her down to hound her with questions about this. I think what it is, I don't know, there's probably lots of amazing words written about this and I haven't formulated them yet in my head, but the reading experience of this book, so immersive. It's so well done. It's such a combination of big ideas and big feels, which I love so much. It's the kind of book that I just yearn to read, and it's absolutely and utterly the kind of book that I want to write. It's just so impressive. So if you haven't read it yet, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin,
it's set around gaming is kind of the world of the book.
Yeah.
I have a opinion on this. I loved this book too. If I was writing a Goodreads review and putting stars against it, I'd give it 4.5 stars.
Right.
I also completely skim read certain sections that I was like, boring.
The games. Yeah, that is so interesting.
The games, but loved the whole book and would still say, like, you know, one of the best books I've read in the last year, but the games, I was like, oh, can't do the games.
Doesn't do it for me. That is so interesting. And I'll say this, I always feel like I'm just, you know, intimately confessing to you and then forgetting that we're doing this on air, but I will, is that because my new book is set across lots of different things and it's the form is different in different places as well. And at one stage I remember thinking, I'll be really okay if people skip these sections. That will be an okay thing. They're here, they're part of the text, they're important to me, they're important to a lot of readers, but some people will just skip these. Like I skip italics often.
Yeah.
You know,
still enjoyable.
Still enjoyable, still part there. They're part of the thing.
And I wouldn't have her remove them. If I was the editor, no. I would still be maybe a bit bored in those sections, but they so help with the meta statement of the book. Yeah. I can see why she saw them as critical and I still love the book. Yeah. I think it's interesting.
So good. Loved it. Yeah. So that's where I'm at with my reading.
This episode, the featured book is brought to you by Text Publishing, and we're talking to Robin Dennison about her debut novel, Blind Spot. Robin Dennison's fiction has appeared in Australian literary journals, including as a runner-up for the Overland VU Short Story Prize. She's a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne, where she teaches creative writing. Blind Spot, her first novel, was shortlisted for the Text Prize. Welcome, Robin.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Massive congratulations on the book. We were just talking off air. It's such an intense read.
Yes. You're not the first person to say that, and I'm sure you won't be the last.
Well, it's the kind of book that really stays with you. We'll start with an elevator pitch so people actually know what we're talking about. Give us the elevator pitch. What is Blind Spot about?
Blind Spot is about a young man named Dale who witnesses but doesn't intervene in the sexual assault of a classmate of his.
When did you know that you wanted to write this story, and where did you begin?
Oh, it was a long time ago now. It was about 10 years ago that I started it, when I was working on a thesis about the representation of sexual violence in young adult fiction. And I think I'd had the kind of original idea for it a little bit before I actually started that thesis. But I kind of started the novel in earnest as the creative component to that thesis, which was a creative writing thesis. So yeah, a while ago, it felt quite different, like social discourse wise, felt a little bit different.
That's interesting. I think what is so interesting about this story is that it is not about the victim of a sexual assault. It's about Dale, this bystander that didn't intervene and stop the assault from happening. You said you sat on the concept for a while. Did you always know the point of view?
Yes. The original idea was always, this is not the victim or survivor's story. This is a bystander's story. And I was aware from the very beginning how thorny that terrain was. But I did specifically want to kind of investigate the questions of responsibility and the way these things are involve all of us and are not just individual stories of like suffering or victimhood or survivorship or recovery.
Yeah. It's really easy, particularly as an initial first response, to judge Dale and to judge his actions or lack of action. How did this idea of judgment, either suspending judgment or Dale's internal judgment or external judgment, how did that figure in the writing of the story?
I think that's one of the reasons why it took me so long to write, was the tension between obviously he's unambiguously in the wrong and he is meant to be judged in the sense of we all are culpable for our actions or inactions and should be held accountable for them. But trying to balance, like knowing that he was always going to be the protagonist and narrator, wanting him to also be sympathetic was a very long and difficult kind of balancing act. He knows he's done something wrong. And I think it's interesting to sit with that kind of almost stillness of like, there's nothing to be done. Or, I mean, there are things to be done, but there's ultimately nothing that's going to take back what he has or hasn't done. And part of, yeah, I can't quite figure out how to say what I'm trying to say, but there is something appealing to me about exploring in fiction that idea of kind of like lack of propulsion or lack of something, some kind of stasis.
You sort of want him to have a really good reason for behaving the way he is, like they had bullied him, the guys involved, or some sort of deeper rationale that we can connect to, but he doesn't. And I think that's what's so interesting about this story is that there's no real reason that he didn't do the right thing.
Yeah, that's true. There's no good reason. I mean, what would be a good reason? I'm not sure, but there's no reason that satisfies our like desire to you know, to have him redeem himself by having done something.
Dale has a cousin, Max. So Dale is 17, Max is 19. Max comes to stay with Dale and his father. Max has her own issues. She's got an eating disorder and Dale is witness to that. Against this kind of backdrop of individual responsibility, when it comes to Max, what kinds of things does Dale grapple with?
I mean, it's kind of the same, like it's kind of a recurring thing where he finds himself as this kind of silent and still bystander, completely at a loss to really grapple with his own even potential role in diverting something. And I think he's very passive. And I think that's one of his journeys throughout the narrative, is kind of understanding that passivity isn't an excuse.
Yeah. I think that's really true. I say to my husband sometimes, I work as an engineer, and when you come up with different options for projects or solutions to problems, there's always a do nothing option. And I think sometimes that kind of passivity, you are actually doing something, you are doing nothing, like that is an option in itself.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we think that, or we can be misled into thinking that it isn't doing something, to just be passive. And that's something I think that part of the story is informed by a passivity that I have or notice in myself, where it's kind of like if you feel a bit overwhelmed by something or you're not sure what the right course of action is, often you can kind of convince yourself that if you're just like passive and still and stay away, it might not, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it might resolve itself.
Maybe.
Hopefully. So as I said, Dale's 17 and Max is 19. They're both in this moment in life on the cusp of adulthood. Do you think there's something special or unique about this time?
I do. I think maybe you could argue that it's purely socially constructed by the way our society is currently kind of operates. But I do think there is something uniquely formative or transformative about late adolescence, even though I disagree with the idea that you kind of only undergo that maturation kind of once and then you're an adult and then your adult identity is stable and enduring. I disagree with that. But I do think there's, yeah, it definitely feels to me like a uniquely significant period of life. But again, maybe that's just because of how we've socially constructed adolescence in our collective imagination.
Robin, we have a lot of listeners to the show that are writers themselves. Once you had the initial seed of an idea for a book, what did the writing of it look like?
As I think I said already, slow. I did write a draft of it in a couple of years. I think I finished the first complete draft of it after 2 or 3 years. And then I did submit it to the text prize, and then I just kind of put it in a drawer and was like, well, I'm done with that because I can't see a way forward. And I didn't really come back to it until 4 or 5 years later during the lockdowns, I think it was. And I kind of thought maybe there's still something here, and rewrote it quite significantly.
So the novel was shortlisted for the text prize, but yes, you submitted it more than once.
That's true. Yes. Right. I submitted it in 2016, I think it was. So quite a few years before.
Right. That's a great story of perseverance paying off.
I guess you could look at it that way. Yeah. I was like, yeah, I don't know.
And how did you find out this time around that you'd been shortlisted?
I got a phone call from someone.
Do you remember what you were doing when you got the call? Did you answer? Obviously you answered, even though it was a number you didn't know.
I did answer. I was in the car on my way to buy a rug for my house.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you get the rug?
We did get the rug.
Forever associated with the positive moment? Or
I mean, a few days later, it was my partner's birthday and the dog vomited on the rug. So I think the main memory that we have associated with the rug. But maybe I should try to shift the main memory of the rug to be about the text prize shortlisting.
Now, not all novels that are shortlisted in the text prize, or in fact, I don't think there's a commitment to publish any novels that are shortlisted as part of the text prize. How did you find out that Blind Spot was, in fact, going to be published?
I got a phone call from my wonderful editor, Jane, at Text, telling me that I, you know, hadn't won, but also saying how much, you know, they liked it. And we kind of had a chat about some things in the novel. And then I kind of went away and made a few changes to the manuscript a little bit, and then sent it back to her. And after that, they offered me a contract. So it was kind of not really an immediate thing at all. Yeah.
It was a series of moments.
Yes.
Blind Spot, we are talking the day before Blind Spot comes out. It will be released into the world tomorrow. What do you hope that readers take away from the book?
I think something you mentioned before that maybe before we started recording, but about the ambiguity of the novel and the sense of even while we know that what Dale's done is wrong, and even while we know that he should have done something, I hope that there's enough kind of nuance in the way it's told that it I guess makes readers think about how we're all involved in these things and what we can all do to change things.
It is definitely a novel that stays with you. And I feel like ambiguity is imbued with in so many elements of it, like which makes it feel true to life.
That's probably my favorite thing to hear, because that's the thing that I love most about the novels that I love. And so that's definitely my kind of main goal, is trying to kind of pin down that sense of irresolution and ambiguity that is true to life.
Mm. Well, you've absolutely succeeded. Robin, I mentioned we've got lots of listeners to the show that are writers. What is either the best or, conversely, the worst writing advice you've ever received?
I think the best writing advice I've ever heard, although I don't know where I heard it and it wasn't given to me personally, is to write for yourself and no one else. And I do really try to not think about the real world as a, you know, I really do try to not think about the idea of real readers at all when I'm writing.
A bit paralyzing, I think.
Yes, I think it can be, especially with a book like this.
Yeah.
maybe.
Final question. Do you have a debut book recommendation? It can be any genre from any year, any place.
I do. The debut book that I've read in the last year that most kind of stuck with me is a novel called Boy Parts by an English writer named Eliza Clark. It's about a woman who takes photographs of men, and it's a fairly it's a bit of an ugly novel in some ways, so I don't know if it's much of a crowd pleaser, but I just gobbled it up like a snack, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And it's about kind of gender and art and violence, and it's got that kind of like millennial female dirtbag kind of nihilist vibe that's had like a bit of a moment. So
that sounds incredible.
What have you been listening to?
I have been listening to The Writer's Room, season two. So this is the podcast where the writers of the Sex and the City sequel and Just Like That, I don't know if Just Like That is known enough now for me not to attach those two things to each other, but that TV show second season has come out, and then on this podcast they discuss the episodes. I think the podcast ellipses the TV show to such an extent. I've only seen in the first season an episode or two, but I have listened to every episode of the podcast. I think the reason that I love it so much is its real minutiae of storytelling, and you get that TV thing of multiple people, I mean, it's called The Writer's Room, but multiple people working on an episode and having perspectives on why they've made certain choices. Someone made the comment on this, I can't remember where it was, but made this statement that they felt that having a podcast about the TV show was sort of almost an acknowledgement of how terrible the TV show is, in that you need this podcast to kind of explain slash justify why you've made these choices and why, you know, why they're justified as choices. I think it's a really interesting podcast. No intention of watching the TV show.
That is so interesting. Is it co-branded? I wonder what the legals are on that.
Yeah.
Did they already plan that they would do it?
I think it was, that's an interesting point. I was going to make the comment that I think they had recorded the first season during the writing, but no, that's not the case. They also have this episode just before this second season comes out where they interview Sarah Jessica Parker, Kristen Davies, and Cynthia Nixon, and talk about Sex and the City and how they got into it, which is a really interesting interview. But I was thinking of that when you were talking earlier about, or even conversations that we've had previously about that idea of Sarah Jessica Parker makes a comment around, well, this is how I think I got into Sex and the City, and this is the story that I tell around the beginning and what I thought and all that. And some of it will be true and some of it is just things that I have repeated. And
so many and now, times. The you know, narrative might be true. Of the narrative. Yeah, completely different thing to the actual truth.
The other podcast that I think I've mentioned on the show before, but just in this vein of really liking that behind the scenes stuff, there's a podcast about Chernobyl, the TV show, which is a similar writer's roomy type thing. It's all about the research that went into that TV show. I've never seen the TV show. Great podcast. Well, just super interesting.
Excellent. Adding both to my list. On that, what are you watching?
I am not watching reality TV at the moment because I think they're between seasons or something in the States. Maybe it has something to do with the States being in summer at the moment.
And also the strike. Does reality TV need writers? I don't know the answer to that question.
That's actually a good point. Possibly not. No. I'm not sure. Producers is what they always talk
needs
about.
Producers, yeah. Well, now the actors are going on strike too, so, you know. So maybe they'll have to bring reality back.
Well, I've got an old-timey recommendation, so maybe this is what we'll be doing. Did you see Planes, Trains, and Automobiles as a kid?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, my God. John Candy was in it. As a kid, I loved John Candy. Our whole family were, like, somewhat obsessed with John Candy, who I looked up recently died when he was only 43. I knew that he died young. Anyway, he made, and it's widely regarded as his best film, is this film, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I think they're actually doing a new version of it. maybe at the moment, and maybe Drew Barrymore is involved somehow. Anyway, it's John Candy and Steve Martin. Steve Martin is a wealthy, crabby guy. John Candy is this goofy sort of salesman. He's a salesman specifically of shower curtain rings.
Yeah, oh, it's coming back to me. It's cute. Coming back to me.
So cute. He's just such a love. He's such a funny actor. He's so funny. Anyway, Steve Martin needs to get home to his family. It's Thanksgiving, so it's just, and then it's been snowing. The planes are delayed. Yeah. They end up catching bizarre forms of transport. They sort of get stuck together, you know, much to Steve Martin's irritation. It is laugh out loud funny in multiple parts. Carney and I watched it with Oscar till he was at a friend's house. Oscar was also into it, possibly a bit young. He's 7. Just, it was so good. I really, really enjoyed it. It stood the test of time. Unfortunately, I then thought all John Candy movies must have stood the test of time.
What did you try next?
I was like, Oscar and Tilly, let's do Uncle Buck. It was not the same experience.
Okay, great. All right.
Definitely maybe don't need to go back to Uncle Buck.
A kind of listicle article, the John Candy movies that have stood the test of time and those that haven't. On movies that have stood the test of time, we managed to get away with only across the whole, you know, 8 nights or whatever of 29 people crazy experience of only doing 2 movie nights. So the kids got a movie on 2 nights. And the best one was that we put on Mighty Ducks. Now, my kids are already massive fans of Mighty Ducks, and some of the kids, other kids were also, because my kids in general are with me and with their dad mostly watch all of the sporting movies with all of the sporting feels. But so we put on Mighty Ducks. By about midway through, not only are the 15 kids lined up in front of it, like already quacking, but the adults start moving over from, you know, the cocktail table to join the back of the couch to also watch their favorite moves until by the end, when that team makes the flying V, we had all 29 of us basically chanting, quack, 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 quack.
That's awesome.
They take the final winning shot, and it was just like, this is the peak of how to watch a show like that with screaming kids and the, you know, the littlest ones looking around going like, this is the best. This is the best way.
So
the adults and the kids are all yelling. So yeah, a tick for watching Mighty Duck with as many people as you can.
Good, because that was pretty good. Mm-hmm. That started that movie started a brief career for me as a rollerblader. I begged my mum to get me rollerblades, and I didn't want Target ones. I wanted the good ones.
Mm-hmm.
So we got good rollerblades. And then I used to make her walk with me up the street. I was probably 16, so like way too old. Walk up the street while I held onto her shoulders and rollerbladed. And it got to the point where we did it so many times. She was like, this is embarrassing. I am refusing not to do this anymore.
Would you ever do it on your own, Catherine Collette?
No, I was hopeless. I was too, like, concerned about injury.
I love that so much. I
probably have them in my shed in pristine condition.
Oh, my gosh. They all, that vintage rollerblades right now, very, very cool. Give them to Tilly or Oscar.
The other just one watching recommendation that I loved as well is Hacks on Stan. Mm. So it's one of those shows that I'd seen people recommend but hadn't taken the time to watch. It's set around a woman who is an older comedian. She, I think, is loosely based on a Joan Rivers type character. So she was doing comedy for many years. She's quite wealthy at a big venue in Vegas, very successful, and they've just told her that it's time to leave, you know, wind it up. So she starts to develop a new show with a younger comedy writer. It is such a good show. I watched 2 seasons back to back. I'm now eagerly awaiting the 3rd season. But I think one of the things that they did so well and is such a mark of good writing on this show is when I compare that show with The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Maisel, yes. Have you watched that?
No.
That's a show around a woman who's also a female comedian. That's probably a thing you're not meant to say, female. She's a woman and she's a comedian. It's set in the 1950s. It's a really good show. I actually enjoyed it. But one of the things with the comedy on that show is you see Mrs. Maisel get up on stage and do this stand-up comedy stuff, and it's not good. So you sort of, as an audience member, have to suspend judgment and just go, okay, so you know, the audience is laughing, but it's not that funny. Yes. Whereas in Hacks, they have really nailed the type of comedy and the jokes within it that she does on stage and all the rest of it. It's so good. Like, not enough episodes.
Yeah.
Need more.
Yeah. I think I only watched the first season because I think maybe I watched that during lockdown, but I can remember really loving it and loving that behind the scenes and the teasing apart of how to land a joke and what comedy is and that back and fro between them writing the new stuff. I thought was
I just think you can see the impact of, well, I attribute it to Hannah Gadsby's Nanette in this, like, I mean, I guess comedy's also always been about social critique, but this real sting in the tail around humour and hard social issues or life experiences and being really honest about those and swinging much more in a pendulum at a really personal level of things that were difficult and finding humour. Like, it's done well.
I think separately to the specificity around humour is also this idea of, you know, pulling back the curtain to see how something is made. And that's actually one of the things that I love so much about Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow is pulling apart the structure and the construct of games and game development and making work and collaborating that I thought was such a really interesting part of it. And actually, the other thing I think about reading the book as a creative that it made me do was be really excited about just getting back to work. Like just that the work itself, the act of creating and making the work is the exciting thing. And I think, you know, that there's, you know, that idea of books for writers and books that, you know, inspire you to write are not necessarily, you know, the great books. And I think this is Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. And things like Hacks are in that vein of making you want to perfect the work, which I think is really exciting too.
Yeah, seeing something done well is really inspiring.
Things that are coming up, one thing that we wanted to mention is something that neither of us are running, but is being run by our amazing friend, Meg Dunley, who is taking a group of writers, not us, unluckily for us, to the amazing Musk where we often retreat. And she is leading a creative retreat. It's called Retreat With Me. The first one is coming up very soon. You may get in, you may not. It's the 27th to the 30th of July. You can check out MegDunley.com to have a look at the details. But let her know if you're keen on the idea, because I'm sure that there will be more offers coming up as well. Meg is our organizer, isn't she, Catherine?
This will be such a good retreat. If I didn't have a writing community already that I go on retreats with, I would 100% go on this retreat. I think she has structured it in that it's 4 days, it's like a welcome drinks at the start, but it's, I think there's a bit of flexibility around, do you want to participate in activities? Do you want a one-on-one with Meg? She's facilitated many creative writing groups and different things over the years, so it's not anything that's particularly new to her. Or you can be a bit more self-guided and self-directed. We love Musk. Like, it is the most, it's a beautiful space. The house is beautiful. It's own bedrooms. It's very comfortable. I think there's something really special in the air.
Also, that idea of, I think Meg something like, you know, let me hold the space for you, said something like, let me hold the space for you. And, you know, Meg's going to organize the food. She's done all of the organizing of where you have to be and what you got to do. And just that beauty, particularly for people who are parents and carers of other people, to be held in that way, sometimes is that start off to what makes an incredible retreat. So that will be amazing. Get in touch with Meg via megdunley.com if you want to find out about future retreats.
2 hours from Melbourne.
Oh, it just makes you want to go. I want to drive there right now.
I think we mentioned not that long ago, the first thing I ever had published was something at RMIT. They have an anthology thing. But the first moment that I felt like a real writer was going on a retreat to Varuna. Yeah, such a special moment, really like a turning point on that journey.
And look where we are now.
I know. I'm going to go on one. Especially after the holidays. My God.
I don't deserve any time off for the rest of my life. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.